Namaste. So we are on the series of Sanatan Dharma, and today we think we'll take up this issue of spiritual life and material life. It's a common question, and sometimes I wonder why this question is there in the Indian context, in the context of Sanatan Dharma. Other religions which are when we say other religions, Sanatana Dharma would include everything within its fold. But religions which have not had their origin in the with the Sanatana background, which became organized religions like Islam, Christianity, they don't have this problem, that worldly life and spiritual life. This problem is very unique to Sanatana Dharma. This what is worth pondering, and it is one reason why a lot of energies have been sapped away or diverted away into certain pathways and bylanes. And despite having such a vast and wonderful background, we see that the energy of the race became impoverished. And this concept came down somewhere that spiritual life is antagonized to material life. Now, why it is not there in certain other religions is very simply because the doctrines or understanding is very simple, that there is one life to start with. And based on how you behave in this life, your beliefs and your actions, you will get a final judgment. So based on what you have done, not done, and very importantly, later on it came that just belief. So if you have a belief, then after that, it doesn't matter what you do, which is very strange and surprising. But if we go back to the origin, it was not like that. It was that you have a certain way of life. Along with the belief, you combine a way of life. Then after death, you stay till finally there is a judgment day. And in that judgment day, you are granted a seat in heaven or in hell. So that was a very simplified way of looking at life. But in Indian thought, a seat in heaven is not regarded as the highest. Partly because there is the concept of rebirth. Meaning thereby, this is not a permanent seat. Unlike, we find in certain religions that once you are in heaven, you are forever in heaven. Or if you are condemned to hell, you are forever in hell. So there is a natural tendency to live a life, if you are, let's say, a true Muslim or a true Christian, to live a life which will ensure you a seat in heaven and prevent you from having a seat in hell. Later on, the distortion came, and a very massive thing, that if you just believe, you are born in a certain religion, by that very fact, and if you have belief by conversion, by that very fact, you have a seat reserved for you in heaven. It doesn't matter what you do or don't do. And as we know, the do's and don'ts got distorted over a period of time, the meaning was lost, and what it has become today, we know that. But in India, the same conception, rebirth, which is a very powerful mechanism, for the evolutionary journey of the soul, becomes sometimes a means for delaying the whole process, that we have rebirth. And the second thing is that implicit within this rebirth mechanism is there is nothing like a permanent seat in heaven. So after a while, you have to come back. So what is a permanent thing after all? It is not a seat in heaven, but it is moksha. So this idea of moksha, that ultimately moksha is the ultimate ideal. Now, moksha began to be understood as renunciation of worldly life, because there is a life of moksha, ultimate salvation, nirvana, mukti, which is a state after which you don't have to come back. So from there the conception came that life upon earth is a field of suffering. So you have to strive for moksha. From heaven you can come back, but from moksha you need not come back. So if moksha is the goal, then the whole tendency was how to arrive at moksha, so that we don't come back. Why? Because coming back is hellish, it is suffering, it is pain, etc. But if we go back, this is a more recent, maybe 1,000-2,000 years understanding of Sanatana Dharma. But Sanatana Dharma is very old. And if we look at the scriptures, original scriptures of Sanatana Dharma, the Vedas, the Upanishads, Sri Krishna's Gita, then we don't find this conception, this understanding of moksha. But something else, and let us speak of that something else. If we go back to the Vedic religion, as we call it, or the days of the Upanishads or the Gita, this otherworldliness is not there. But what is the insistence of making earth and heaven one, equal? The Vedic aspiration is always to, they have seen a state of permanent beyond, but they want it to become one and same. Now, rebirth was a mechanism for a progressive evolution of the soul, and the world was a means for manifesting the divine in creation, which is a very different thing. So the whole stress was how to link this creation to the creator, rather than discover a disembodied state and go back to the creator and become one with him. So if you really go back to the roots of Sanatana Dharma in far back ancient times, you see everything was connected to the creator in countless ways, whether it be science or art, or music, painting, dance, polity, administration. And we have spoken about that in different contexts in this series, that how everything was connected. Relationships, marriage, everything was childbirth, child's going to schooling, everything, there was an effort to connect it to the creator. And that is why we see a very vast understanding of creation and the creator's relation came in. That often people say that, you know, why Murti Puja, why mountains, rivers, everything is to be worshipped because in everything there dwells the one. Now, this is a very mind-boggling, very vast understanding of life. It's very easy to say that this is life, material life, and that is spiritual life. So you leave this whole field and you go there. But the problem comes that when you say that all this is inhabited by a divine presence, so there are two, three questions which arise from it. First of all, then what is really moksha? Moksha is, if we look back into the far back times, and that's beautiful statement of Shri Krishna, revelation of Shri Krishna to Arjuna, that Arjuna, you and me have fought this great battle of the ages, life after life. You have forgotten it, but I remember it. So this very cryptic thing is not about Arjuna, it's about the relation of divine with humanity. That we are all together on a march of mankind, Lok Sangrahart, a whole evolutionary process. And what is this evolution about? It's about a progressive divine manifestation in creation. Now, when we look at the whole life like that, then our relationship changes. So, how does it change? First of all, there is a divine presence in everything. This is the first fundamental truth of Sanatana Dharma. We can find it either within ourselves or we can find it in our relationship with the world, because everything contains potentially the divine presence. You can literally pick up a piece of stone and you can discover the divine presence inside, because it's potentially there. That's why, you know, it's very interesting. If you see many of these weapons, shastras, Pashupati Astra and this Astra and that Astra, the commonest one which is known is Brahmastra. Now, people often think Brahmastra is about putting an arrow and then shooting it. But Brahmastra is one astra which can be used without, you can pick up a blade of grass and turn it into Brahmastra. That is what you see in the Mahabharata. When Ashwatthama is cornered, he picks up a blade of grass and turns it into Brahmastra. Now, it is based on the principle that the divine presence and the power which has gone into creation, it is there even in a blade of grass. So, we can, by concentrating and focusing on anything, going deep into it, we can discover the divine presence. It's amazing. But because when we go through something outward, it is very easy to be lost in the surface personality. For instance, very difficult to, you know, when we deal with a dog or a cat, to get rid of the idea that it is not a dog or a cat, but it is Brahman, it is the divine who has come to your door. It's very difficult because there is the human wailing, there is the conditioning of the mind, habit and all that which will come into play. Grass, how can it be divine? I am treading on it. All these conceptions will come. But when we go within, we cut through that layer. We enter into the subjective spaces of our own being. So it's a little easier to discover the divine presence within than to discover the divine presence outside. But if we look back again to the Sanatana Dharma, both are important simultaneously. It is not enough to discover the divine presence within. In fact, the truth of the matter is that the more we discover the divine presence within, you spontaneously begin to discover it in others. How does it happen? It's very simple. If we look at the, again, we have to deal with some of these truths which are which we have forgotten. World is like a mirror. So what we see in the world is what is there within us. So somebody like Duryodhana feels always insecure. Why is insecure? Yudhishthira doesn't want to usurp his throne. But he is insecure because he wants to usurp the throne. So his fear he projects. Now it's a very profound lesson of psychology that in our everyday life, at a collective level, you see there are groups of humanity who are always fighting and wanting to conquer others. Why? Because there is an insecurity, because they are ambitious, they think that everybody else is ambitious and everybody else is there after your throne. So human nature is such that the world is like a mirror, and we see in this world what we see in ourselves. Now, if you apply this principle and take it deeper, if we discover the divine within us, if we discover beauty within us, spontaneously we'll begin to see beauty and divinity in others. And the mother uses this very beautiful expression that when we have dealt with our own difficulties and challenges, then we develop what is called as a sunny tolerance and generosity towards everything else, because we discover how difficult it is to cut through these layers and discover the divine presence. So one of the paths that is given to discover the divine within creation is first discover within you. If you discover it, you will discover it everywhere. So how to discover it? Well, there again we have the conception of vidya and avidya. So what is avidya? Avidya or ignorance, it is to be lost in the multiplicity. Now let's take an example, very simple example. Every day many of us are playing many roles. We are sometimes a teacher, sometimes a student, we are in the workplace, we are at home. We are playing in a day at least two or three roles, isn't it? Now what happens, and also we are what we are in our private life, our inner world, our dream world, which is our own relation to ourselves. Now look at what happens when a person is working. He is absorbed in the work. At that time, if a child comes and draws the attention, what is the reaction? Don't disturb me now. There are people who are too absorbed and they can even get angry. Now, after some time, what happens? Now there is a switching on of another role. One realizes, oh, I am a father, I am a mother also. Goes to the child, hugs the child, says, I am so sorry, you see, I don't mean it, you know, I was working. Now, why this happened? I am taking a very small example. Because of the absorption of consciousness and intense concentration, I am identified with one small aspect of my being. At that point of time, it is part of the work. Otherwise, I can't function normally, ordinarily. And then I become oblivious of everything else. Now, this is avidya. Again needed for the work, for the manifestation itself. The divine himself forgets himself into creations. That's how this creation, you know, such a wonderful creation comes. But he's also aware of himself as someone or something, as a being, a consciousness which is other than this creation. But we don't have that art. So we completely lose ourselves. This is also called as an aspect of the divine, the charobhav, the divine in the mutable, ever-changing world. Otherwise, you cannot have creation. So it's like a role that we are playing. Now, a very interesting thing happens before we get back to how to really discover the state of the divinity within. Now, over a period of time, through many lives as we progress, we accumulate many, many such personalities begin to develop within us, not just one. See, in one life we have given an example of, you know, we are doing a job and we are, you know, at home of father, mother, or for children, student and child. But over a period of time, many personalities accumulate within a human being. The personality of a musician, it's not about being a musician, but there is a personality of a musician. Personality of a poet, it's not about writing poetry. Personality of an athlete. So there are many such personalities which begin to accumulate within us, and in a given life, only one or two will express themselves. Now all these personalities, where are they? In waking life, they are not manifesting. When I am doing a work, where is my parent part? Now that part where all these things are kept in limbo, in hanging. They are there, but they are there in some other state. That is called as the dream state. There is the waking state and there is the dream state. In dream state, we are not tied to this waking consciousness. So waking consciousness, where we fix, okay, I am doing a work. Now this is it. Where is all my fantasy life, all my other things? They are all within my dream state. So dream state is a more fluid state, a more vast state. It envelops my waking state like a robe or a cloth is on the wearer. It surrounds me, but I am not aware of it. But when do I become aware? When a child sits suddenly, when he has no more homework, what do children do? Before the WhatsApp thing came into existence, they entered into their dream world. That was a very, I must say, it was a fantastic thing which now is gone. Because now there is always, our consciousness is projected onto the waking state. Otherwise, when all this was not there, you could withdraw. Because you have no other choice. Your mind will start playing your own television. It's a world of your own. Now, in the dream state, what is happening? You are preparing for things which will manifest in the material world or the waking consciousness. So, if you want your waking state to be beautiful and perfect, you have to master your dream state. Dream state has nothing to do with only dreaming. But in dreaming, we can have some idea. Who are we in dreaming state? Do we remember? I am somebody's son, somebody's daughter, somebody's this. No, it is totally a different dimension. In dream state, other personalities are at play. We can even bring them out through hypnosis. So there are two ways of bringing out. One is a wrong hypnosis, where we can bring out certain very dark and dangerous elements. Sometime one has to confront them, but if done prematurely, it can be very dangerous. But we can also bring out, recover certain personalities which are there hidden inside. But a yogin actually recovers them. Mother speaks of it at one point of time. Many past personalities of hers started coming. She describes one of them, and it's not feminine or masculine. She says it's one of them is a man. So the disciple is wondering that how can, you know, because normally the soul chooses a certain line. She says, no, it is that element. So she gives the example of Murat. Murat was a famous general during all this, French Revolution and all that. He says, I was the victorious spirit in Murat. Like in Shivaji, the victorious spirit in Shivaji, that power that moved him. So all these personalities, you'll see in a very interesting story in Shiva Puran, that when Parvati marries Shiva and comes to his abode, so there is a cave where Shiva has told her, there, don't go there. So she obeys. But one day she's very curious that he's supposed to share everything with me. Why hasn't he shared this? And Shiva, Shiva turns a blind, deaf ear to it, as if he hasn't heard the request. But she says that, you are my husband. You can't hide anything from me. You have to share it at some point of time. But Shiva says, no, this is not the time to share it. Then one day, when Shiva is in his mighty trance, she enters. And as she enters that cave, she is taken aback because there are many, many beings who start coming to her, craving her attention, wanting her presence. And, she is completely lost, confused that what is happening to me? And they all come and it's like a whole complex of, you have entered into the world teeming with presences, beings, consciousnesses, energies. And then finally when she comes back to cut the story short, she says, who are they? She says, your own aspects. They have come to be integrated. But it is premature. You have to reach a certain point of development. Then only you can integrate them. Now it's a very profound psychology which, modern psychology is very far from understanding it. And these are not multiple personalities. They are your own different aspects. So what happens beyond the dream state? Now dream state, out of that you select one or two and manifest in a particular life. In one life you want to express a certain aspect. Let's say beauty and harmony. So you may be having a warrior spirit, but it is behind. You don't express it. You manifest this. Then this dream state, which is behind the waking state, they are called as Jagrata and Swapnavastha. There is something still beyond it, and that is called Sushupti. Now that is the state of Pragya, where all these two, you know, they have different names, Virat, Hiranyagarbha and Pragya, or Hiranyagarbha also, the Taijasa. So the dream state itself is a selection from Pragya, from Sushupti, where your original truth is there, which we have completely forgotten. We have entered into this game and out of the dream state. So we go back after death, we recover all this, go back to that state of sleep, and finally from there we decide what we are going to take for the coming life. So you make a selection. Okay, done this, tick mark, tick mark, tick mark. Oh, this I will manifest. So, you know, you cast those seeds out of sleep state into the dream state, out of dream, further selection into the waking state. And we think we are that. Why? Because we are completely identified. How we are identified? By a complete concentration. And there is a fourth state which further surrounds the sleep state, and that is the ultimate reality, call it Parabrahman or whatever we want to call it. So there is Jagrata, there is Swapna, there is Susupti, and there is Turiya. Now always, all these are there always together, simultaneously. Meaning thereby, even when we are leading a life of utter avidya, ignorance, completely identified, oh, I am this being, this creature, I am suffering and feeling happy, this original fellow is always there. That is our true self. But we don't know. Just as a person who is working forgets himself in the work. And it's important. Imagine a person who is to fix some nails in the wall. It's not good to fix nails in the wall, incidentally. But it's okay. Supposing you are given. Can you afford to let your concentration waver somewhere else? You will hit yourself. Or a warrior. Imagine if he starts thinking, I am this, that, then he cannot really have the fight the battle for which he is born. But how are we to recover this true self? This is the first step, by exactly the same process with which we lost it. By concentration we lost it, by reverse concentration we can find it. It's very simple. What is meant by reverse concentration? Now we have to start by concentrating on this, start with the idea, because, you know, where does this sorting out takes place? In the mind. Mind picks up this, arranges things, says this, this, this. That's why it is the formative Maya. So you have to go beyond the mind. So you start with the mind, because you cannot go beyond the mind just like that. So pick up from the mind the highest idea that you can conceive of, and become that idea. That is what Swami Vivekananda says, no, so beautifully. Pick up one idea. Let it flow into your veins. Otherwise, our consciousness will not, if we 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes sit in meditation and say that, okay, aham brahmasmi, then one becomes, one is still identified. But if we pick up that idea, one idea, single idea, if we want to approach through the mind, there is another approach also. So we can pick up one idea that, well, all this that is Brahman. Very beautifully described in one phrase, Sarva Khalu Vidam Brahman. All this is Brahman. Now we will say, yeah, this is hallucination. No, if you ask a spiritual person, he'll say, no, sir, this is hallucination. This is what you think, this is delusion, this is moha. But you are so badly tied in it, you cannot. Now when we concentrate on this idea, which will mean for some time we have to, there will be a stage when we will not be fully connected with the world, because you can't help it. Otherwise you will totally get involved. If you take the path of jnana, then you concentrate on this idea, till one day this idea bites tapas, heat. This is tapasya. Tapasya has nothing to do with kamandalu and dand and into a forest. All this is sheer television. Tapasya is to pick up one idea and concentrate till one day the idea yields the reality behind it. Idea is not the reality, it is a symbol. There is divine, but we don't know what is divine. We have conceptions of divine. But all this is Brahman, all this is Brahman, one day it explodes by the energy. Now, depending upon, we need to have a certain degree of mental intelligence, which is like quantity of consciousness, and we need to have the power of concentration. These are two things required. And if we do it sincerely, one day it will burst and suddenly we will start feeling a presence all around. It is very disorienting, incidentally, this experience. Because suddenly it's another state you have entered, which we have not normally, we are not accustomed to that state. Then we have done it, we have a choice to withdraw or to reconnect it. Now the bulk of Indian thought is to reconnect that state of consciousness with this world. And that is where the whole rub lies, the whole art lies. So if we really look at, this is of course, let's complete all the process. So one is by the idea. Second is a reverse concentration by the way of the heart. Normally, whom do we love? Myself. No, I love my family. No, we love myself. Family because of myself. For my ego, for my this thing. No, I love my country. No, myself. Because it's your country, therefore you love it. If you are born in some other country, you will love that country. So it is myself. So therefore, this too becomes an avidya. But if we love all beings, all things, with this consciousness that, well, we are loving the one. You know, several times I have shared this story of Draupadi. I think it's a good time to remember it again. So Draupadi is, goes to the highest state. She's again one of those five women who are worshipped. So there is a dialogue which takes place between Draupadi and Savitri. So Savitri says, I am a sati for sure. All my life I have just been one-pointedly focused on my husband. He is God for me. If you read Savitri, it's amazing. She says, God has come to me in this form. Assume the name of Satyavan. Bring me, I am ready to worship another God, provided he assumes the form of Satyavan. It looks very strange that how can you do that? He's a human being. But Savitri, by the power of her concentration, it's not just that, you know, Satyavan is an incarnation. It's something very real. That's where we see in Indian, ancient Indian concept. She says, by the power of concentration, I have realized God eternal in him. And therefore, for me, he is God. And therefore, I have deserved this highest state, because by loving anything to the core, I have gone to discover the principle of divine love. But what about you? So Draupadi says, I have also loved only one. See, two paths. Oh, you loved only one, but you had five husbands. Ah, I know. But I loved only one. So you were partial to Arjuna? Says, no. How can you have five husbands, not be partial to Arjuna, and yet you claim I loved only one? Says, yes, I loved only Krishna. Now you see, there are two approaches here. One is, whatever be the object of love, and these are all there in Mother and Shobindo's writings, you go to a point of adoration, you will find the principle of divine love. Your all the difficulties and challenges will be there, which in any bhakti yoga there, virahe, abhiman, everything will be there, because we start with imperfection. But if you go deep inside, you will discover it. But equally, you can be with the world and love only the divine. You know, that Sri Aurobindo's famous aphorism, and Mother gave an interesting commentary on it. What is the aphorism of Sri Aurobindo? He says, this world has been perfectly created. Exact words maybe here and there, but this world has been created perfectly to commit adultery with God. We owe to this world an obligation of duty. As towards a husband. Obligation. You know, duty you have to do. But secretly, we always cherish the divine paramour and beloved. Secretly, the soul loves only him. But outwardly, you have obligation of duty. How in one aphorism, there are many layers that Sri Aurobindo brings out. And when Mother is asked to comment upon this, she says, as always, Sri Aurobindo breaks all these moral notions and these in which human beings are trapped. Because you love only the divine. And if you see what a profound truth, actually in every human being, we are searching for that divinity. And because we don't find it, we are unhappy. This is the cause of frustration in relationship. Because we don't find it. Now why we don't find it? Because we have conception of divinity. But divine is beyond all conceptions. So because we have conceptions, we have imposed, same thing happens with the divine. People say, oh, divine is very loving. Then first thing that happens in their life, which is not according to our idea of what divine love would mean, we say, oh, you are, people start complaining. Why? Because we don't understand that divine in his love, intense love, like Krishna on the Kurukshetra, he's destroying everything. Ask Krishna why you are doing, he says, you know, because I am the eternal lover of mankind. That's how Shivindra describes, no? He rides in the car and he strikes in the spears. He wars for the world and his ultimate years. The master of man and his infinite lover. Simultaneously, how can he be an infinite lover and yet destroy? Because that is the heart, that is the state of consciousness. What he is destroying is the forms. So that the spirit can be liberated, just like Shiva destroys. Now this is the difference between playing the game consciously and unconsciously. And Shubhendu gives a very beautiful example, again drawing from the story of Sagar Manthan. We know that Shiva loves snakes. Why does he love snakes? He loves snakes because like Shiva, they have taken to absorb the poison of the world. That's why Shiva also loves asuras. Because in this world you have both. You have beauty and you have ugliness. You have, you know, all the bright and luminous thing. You have also darkness. Darkness has to be transformed into light. But to start with, there are beings who hold this darkness with them. To start with, all the bitterness, all the power. What is poison? All this bitterness, unhappiness. So there are beings, you know, you have to keep it somewhere so that it can be transformed. So where is it kept? In some beings, like snakes carry poison inside their poison glands. So he says he loves the asuras. Why? Because asuras are those who hold the poison inside them. That's why they are full of anger, spite, wrath, even fear, terror, all this. Why it has come into the world play? We can talk about it little later. Because ultimately it's the one. But Shubhendu cautions, but what is the difference? What the asura does unconsciously, when you do consciously, then you are a god. This is the difference. Shiva does consciously. What does he do? He takes the poison of the world and stains his throat. That's why Kali is mother. She destroys with impunity. But why she is mother? She consciously plunges into the darkness. See, always... Kali, to the worshipper of the Divine Mother, to the gods, to those who love her, she manifests as Parvati, as Gauri, the fair one. Nothing to do with color of the skin, for God's sake. Fair one. She embodies the bright, luminous powers inside her. But to those, the asuric beings, she becomes Kali. Why does she become Kali? Because she identifies with them. This drinking their blood, she completely identifies with them. Look at the love. She comes into their midst and dances. And then two asuras have a choice to surrender and say, here my head is there, take it as an offering. And then he is released. Or else she will make the asura one with him, her. That's what is meant by slaying and drinking the blood. She will make them one with her. This is intense love. Her love is so intense that she plunges into darkness, becomes dark robed. And out of love, she draws them close. They are not willing, not ready. They can't surrender. So she says, okay, doesn't matter. You don't surrender. I'll snatch you away and make yourself one with me. So when we look at it from that perspective, we see that it's a play. The divine is playing with himself. We have forgotten that we too in our secret consciousness are divine and everybody in their secret consciousness are divine. So when we know it, we can play the play consciously. And that is the difference between when you have a game of cricket between India and Pakistan and when you have the war. Game of cricket is also war. But you know this is a game. You want to win. You do everything. But at the end of the day, you say, okay, let's go in the evening and celebrate. But when you are in war, you forget all this. But even there, if a soldier meets a soldier, there are so many stories like that. He realizes that it's not between you and me. I'm sorry, it's between some two powers. You and me are pawns, isn't it? That soldier recognizes that I have no enmity with you. There is no personal enmity. But at that point of time, he forgets all this. Now this is avidya. What is avidya? To forget the one. But when you remember the one and then play the game, everything you can do. Now imagine, when you do this, how will it differ from the ordinary action on avidya, when we do it in avidya? The difference is huge. First, when we do the same thing in avidya, we take on all the ill effects, the reactions that arise all around. See, when we, let's take an example of battle. Now when people do with, supposing with that, you know, there are armies who, they can't be called armies, they mutilate, they do all kinds of things. So what happens? The lot of reaction which arises from within you and from those who are the recipients of all this pain and suffering. Now this reactions which arises, it pollutes the whole atmosphere. I'm taking an extreme example, because how spiritual life, you can fight a battle and you will be different. When in ignorance you are fighting, like the asuras and rakshasas, and you are fighting with that state of consciousness, with anger, wrath, greed, ambition, lust for power, fear. So what happens? Bodies are destroyed anyways, but things arise, poison arises. Now that poison spreads into the world. It even, you carry that something of that as the soul passes away after death. You carry that state of spitefulness. That's why in depression, when people commit suicide, so dangerous, because that state of consciousness is so heavy. It is the dress you take upon yourself as you go past the gates of birth and death. It's very heavy. So it's something which stays, lingers in the atmosphere. But take another scenario. As we find in the ancient times in Sanatan Dharma age, how was the war fought? Daytime, we fight the war. Evening time, we can go meet our friends. Can you imagine this happening in modern times? So who will win? It's not about I cross a boundary line and occupy a space. So war became a school of valor and courage. Now imagine when you fight with that state. First of all, when we fight, and I'm taking only one example, it will apply in business and everything else, but an extreme example, if it can apply here, it will apply everywhere. Now imagine we are fighting in a state of spite, anger, hatred, fear, or we are doing anything with all that. What is happening? Our energy is getting dissipated into many directions. Of course, anger helps you to concentrate on a particular object which you want to demolish. But it's a very bad fuel, because it's causing a lot of reactions within you. But if all these energies which are being dissipated in all this avidya's world are completely mastered, now what happens? They are available for you. And now they are, you can use it for the real battle. So there is a difference between the valor of the Kshatriya, the courage of the Kshatriya, and the aggression which is of the Asura. Weak natures are very violent. Whereas you can fight a battle without a state of violence inside. You can be in a complete state of that you don't mean any ill, any harm. But then of course you will not fight a battle for expanding your empire. You will not fight an unjust battle. That's why in Sanatana Dharma there is the concept of just battle. What is a just battle? A battle which is fought in self-defense. That's the only justification of a battle. When something is, or when you have to fight a person, you have to have the strength to fight an aggressor. When somebody is doing something which is wrong, evil, you have to stay the hands. But you don't do it because you want to your ambition or show off of your strength. You do it because you know that it's a courage which is expressing itself. Courage as the motivator vis-a-vis ambition and anger as a motivator. Which is a better fuel? courage and valor help our soul to ascend. Whereas fear and anger pull it down. So even in battle, your eye is on the higher state. If we do an action in a state of consciousness which is more godlike, the same action, absolutely same, there is no difference. That is the beauty of the Gita. And it gives the example of war. And when Sri Aurobindo was asked about it, he said, he writes this beautiful letter, I do not take business as something evil, or for that matter, even a ghor karma like war. War is described as a ghor karma. There is no karma which is, you are killing somebody, you know, in war. And he says that otherwise the whole Gita is meaningless. That's why you see, Gita is not just about symbolic journey inside. The Gita, by its practical example, emphasizes that even the most difficult karma. Now, Shri Krishna speaks about sarva karmani. But if you can fight a war where you are actually killing human beings, which is the ultimate, you know, no other karma can be as, if you look at it only from the basis of the action itself, can be as heavy, ghora, as supposed to be dark and obscure as taking someone's life. But even that karma can be done in a state of consciousness where it can help your soul to progress and help the soul of somebody else to progress. And that is why you see there was a principle, another principle in Sanatana Dharma in war. What were the rules of war? One of them was this. Second was, you'll never fight with somebody who is without any astra shastra. Why? Because then what will be his state? He will be in a state of fear, terror, anger. So even for him it is not a good state to be in. So you have to fight in a state where you pick up, there is courage against courage. So whoever falls, the killer and the killed, they both are in a beautiful state to take the further journey. Then of course people ask, why Karna and why Dronacharya and why Bhishma and why Abhimanyu? Now Sri Aurobindo answers it very beautifully. Now Mahabharata war, because we have taken up this point, we can just quickly touch upon it. Mahabharata war is not an individual battle. It's a war where the fate of a civilization is to be decided. No doubt it is. Nobody can justify that firing an arrow at an unarmed Karna, regardless of his shrap and all that, shrap doesn't justify Arjuna's actions. Shrap is there, but still Arjuna fires a salvo and Shri Krishna advises him to do so. Why is it justified? Because at that point of time, it is not about Arjuna and Karna. It is about the larger context. If Arjuna would not have fought this war and killed Karna at that point of time, maybe individually people would have said, oh Arjuna, look at him. Wonderful. Look at Shri Krishna. Even during this time, he didn't tell Arjuna. He held his bow, said, no. Wait, let him come up into the rath and then you fight. Krishna could have done it. But for Krishna at that point of time, it was the fate of a whole civilization. Karna is standing as a shield for Duryodhana, who is the symbol of Adharma. And therefore the killing of Karna is justified. But even there, there was a very interesting principle that when you fight such an enemy in such a state, don't use an ordinary weapon. You use a weapon which is mantra-vidh. Now what is the difference between a mantra-vidh weapon and an ordinary weapon? That is in ancient times. When you use a mantra with the weapon, what was called as Divyastra. Doesn't matter what state you kill the person in. Because it's Divyastra, by its nature, it carries you upward. So Shri Krishna tells him, he's the candidate for Divyastra. Use the Divyastra and fight him. So he knew it is something which is individually not a meritorious thing to do. And yet, there are times when it is not about individual dharma. It's about the collective. It is about the larger dharma. Imagine if you fight the Chinese or Hitler saying, I'll fight by the rules of the game. Then what will happen? You will see very soon that in Delhi you have a red flag. Or a green flag or whatever flag. You can't say, well, I'm fighting the rules of the game like our previous Okay, you want a piece of land. Land is what? Nothing. Not a blade of grass grows there. Take it for 1 rupee. Now you see, you have become great in your own eyes and eyes of some people, but you have committed a great blunder and causes the degeneration of the race. So that's why Shri Krishna tells in the Gita, Gahano Karmani Gati. It's very difficult to decide what is karma, what is vikarma, what is akarma. Very difficult. Gahano Karmani Gati. And then he says, the one who knows doesn't create a confusion in the minds of those who do not know. Because you have to see the march of civilization together, the whole. When Sri Aurobindo was asked in the context of Hitler, that do you mean to say that Britishers are good people? They are pretty asuric. He says, yes, I know they are asuric. They are not good people. And then he gives the example. You think in Mahabharata war, Pandavas and their side, everybody was good guy? No. Drupad was fighting out of personal enmity. Both sides, there were people who had come to sort out their own issues. So he said, it's not that allies are all, you know, good guys. But I still want the allies to win. Because if the Axis power win, the Earth's future evolution will go back 10,000 years. Whereas if the allies win, the path of evolution will be kept open. Same thing happened as with Krishna, that people blamed Sri Aurobindo. They didn't know that secretly he is conducting the battle. Otherwise they would have, God knows. But they said that why is he with the allies? Even within the ashram, people didn't understand. Much later when Schindler's List now and all this came out, oh my God, this was Hitler. Such a tremendous asuric power. But that time, so Sri Aurobindo didn't mind that people will, you know, call him names. But he did, because it was for the good of the world. That time it was not even India. It was the good of humanity and world. So everything else was kept in the background. So that is why when we speak about action, the Sanatana Dharma gives us a very wide, broad, deep perspective of how to act in the world. It doesn't put things into a bracket. This is good, this is bad, or, you know, this is material life, this is spiritual life. No, we can lead the material life, do the same thing in a most material consciousness. And we can lead a material life, a life of richness, beauty, everything, but with the highest spiritual consciousness, just to spread beauty in a detached way, unattached. Unattached is not indifference. And that's what we will read today. Otherwise, I'm just flowing with it. So last time we spoke about renunciation. So people often ask, renunciation means leave the world and go away. This is what everybody understands. So people think it makes you weak. Weakness has no place in spiritual life. Na yamatma balhine. Spiritual life is for the strong. And we have these wonderful words of Sri Aurobindo. When he says, why do people talk about renunciation in terms of outer living? Why? Because they are afraid of the world contact. He says, that is a weakness. How can you, if you are afraid of the world contact, even dare to find God? Dare, because it's a big adventure. Or for nirvana, it's a selfish shame. Or because you think it's a bondage, again, a weakness. It's an illusion that, you know, we suffer from. So, now he says, lowest causes of all are the weakness that shrinks from the struggle, the disgust and disappointment of the soul, baffled by the great cosmic labor. This selfishness that cares not what becomes of those left behind us. So that's what, you know, Arjuna taking sannyasa. Oh, Arjuna, what a great, another Tirthankar added to the list. He would have, imagine a warrior, like another Ashoka. But he says, what about the good of humanity? Cosmic labor, selfishness. So long as we personally can be free from the monstrous, ever-circling wheel of death and rebirth, the indifference to the cry that rises up from a laboring humanity. I don't care about others. I am only busy with my own nirvana. And people who do it are very worried about their own kamandalu and their own, you know, my pocket, my coffers. But look at now what Sri Aurobindo is going to say are like tonic. For the sadhak of an integral yoga, none of these reasons are valid. With weakness and selfishness, however spiritual in their guise or trend, he can have no dealings. A divine strength and courage and a divine compassion and helpfulness are the very stuff of that which he would be. They are that very nature of the divine which he would take upon himself as a robe of spiritual light and beauty. It's not about wearing white or gerua or any dress. What is his robe he wears? His robe is compassion, courage, strength, generosity, plunging into creation to help and rescue and save. The revolvings of the great wheel bring to him no sense of terror or giddiness. Oh, but you are delaying your own progress. There is only one progress, and there is the progress of creation toward the divine. He rises above it in his soul and knows from above their divine law and their divine purpose. The difficulty of harmonizing the divine life with human living, of being in God and yet living in man, is the very difficulty that is set here to solve and not to shun. So we say all human life, it's all bandhan. So he takes to a recourse of divine. But this is the task of resolving this. This is the challenge. It's very easy to cut off and discover that within. He has learned that the joy, the peace, and the deliverance are an imperfect crown and no real possession if they do not form a state secure in itself. Imperfect is the joy not shared by all. Imagine if you find something very beautiful. What is your first tendency? To share it with those whom you love. It is incomplete without that. So when you love all mankind, all creation, how would you want to only keep it to yourself? Inalienable to the soul, not dependent on aloofness and inaction, but firm in the storm and the race and the battle. If you can keep that state, like, you know, in the battlefield. Unsullied, whether by the joy of the world or by its suffering. That's what we spoke about in the example of King Janak. And Sri Aurobindo says, Janak is not one king. It's a lineage. It was a way of life. That is the ancient Sanatana Dharma. Not world-shunning ascetics running away into, you know, they start by abandoning house, abandoning this, then their dress, then their body. And we have that famous story of Sikhi Darjan Chudala. I think I have already spoken about it. But what is to be really abandoned, renounced, that he will come to? The ecstasy of the divine embrace will not abandon him because he obeys the impulse of divine love for God in humanity. We think God will abandon us if we love human beings. I am supposed to love only God. But who is in human beings? He who is hiding. Why only human beings? In whole creation. Or if it seems to draw back from him for a while, he knows by experience that it is to try and test him still farther so that some imperfection in his own way of meeting it may fall away from him. So instead of being disillusioned, when Madhava says, Mother, when you trust people and people don't keep your trust, what is it about? He says that means your faith is not strong enough. She didn't blame the other person. Your faith is not strong enough. So it means that instead of withdrawing, oh, world is like that, you get disillusioned, talk about vairagya, tamasic vairagya. It has no power. Tamasic vairagya has no power. In Sri Aurobindo doesn't even mention it. Even Sri Krishna, this vairagya, so much celebrated. Vairagya has a power only if it is sattvic, luminous, where you understand the nature of life. Otherwise, tamasic and rajasic vairagya have no power to take us towards spiritual height. Personal salvation. So what it means is that he will engage, even if it looks for a moment that the divine presence is veiled. He knows that I have to make this perfect. There is something missing which I have not done, not completed. And when you do it, it is always there. He is always there. personal salvation he does not seek except as a necessity for the human fulfillment, and because he who is himself in bonds cannot easily free others. So you have to, the only purpose of moksha is that you are freed from ignorance, this sense of I-ness and my-ness. Then you play the game and see the delight. Though to God nothing is impossible, even if you are in bonds, Krishna used Arjuna and everybody. For a heaven of personal joys, he has no hankerings, even as a hell of personal sufferings has for him no terrors. You know, you feel Sri Krishna is telling Arjuna. Such is the state in which we should rise. If there is an opposition between the spiritual life and that of the world, it is that gulf which is here to bridge. That opposition which is here to change into harmony. If the world is ruled by the flesh and the devil, all the more reason that the children of immortality should be here to conquer it for God and the Spirit. If life is an insanity, then there are so many million souls to whom there must be brought the light of divine reason. If a dream, yet is it real within itself? To so many dreamers who must be brought either to dream nobler dreams or to awaken. Or if a lie, then the truth has to be given to the deluded. So in Sri Aurobindo's yoga, Sri Aurobindo's vision, as in Sri Krishna's, illusion is not non-existence. It cannot be. Illusion is a distortion of truth. So every activity, it may start with a distortion, but you have to keep evolving it till you discover the truth behind it. Every activity you can take it to those sublime heights. And that is the task. But it's a pain. That's the tapasya. What else is tapasya? Tapasya is not that, okay, I am disillusioned, I'll sit and in a cave or, you know, I'll sit in meditation. Every activity you start with, because the starting is darkness, unconsciousness, ignorance. Of course, if the starting is knowledge and wisdom, then it's a wonderful thing. Then you can still enter into ignorance, but you do it very consciously. But the starting may be ignorance, doesn't matter. It can still be taken to great heights. Nor, if it be said that only by the luminous example of escape from the world can we help the world, shall we accept that dogma, since the contrary example of great avatars is there to show that not only by rejecting the life of the world as it is can we help, but also and more by accepting and uplifting it. So, and then he says very beautifully that what is the difference? How to do it? He says, again, our renunciation must obviously be an inward renunciation. And then he qualifies it. What is the meaning of that? Especially and above all, a renunciation of attachment and the craving of desire in the senses and the heart, of self-will in the thought, it should be my way or no way, and action, it should be only this way, and of egoism in the center of the consciousness. For these things are the three knots by which we are bound to our lower nature. And if we can renounce these utterly, there is nothing else that can bind us. And then he says beautifully, and this does not mean that there is nothing at all that we shall love, nothing in which we shall take delight, for attachment is egoism in love. This is what? Self-will. My way. That is how. Whatever I believe, you must believe. Whatever I think, you must think like that. There's no freedom in that. That's why the greatest act of love is the act of freedom. So this attachment, self-will, craving, you are there to satisfy my desires, my heart's hunger. If you don't satisfy it, now imagine the difference, a very subtle line. You rejoice in each other or with the whole world. But the moment you turn it into a want, you have the craving. So such a thin line. Obviously, when people who cherish each other meet, they are happy. But when it takes the form of craving and dependency and attachment, then this, it's a very, very thin line. If you see, very imperceptible. Mother speaks of the world of truth and the world of falsehood. They're close to each other, running like a very thin line that divides. Very often people throw the baby with the bathwater. Oh, I should be detached. So they become indifferent, aloof. But true detachment brings love. It frees love. Desire is limitation and insecurity in a hunger for pleasure and satisfaction and not the seeking after the divine delight in things. Insecurity. If I don't possess, oh, what may happen? I must possess it. Then after possession, dominate, control. It's for me, mine. That's where the whole problem comes. Self-will in thought and action has, we have already seen, to be quite renounced. But then he goes straight to the real problem. But the center of all resistance is egoism. And this we must pursue into every covert and disguise and drag it out and slay it. Egoism is basically attachment to me, minus, I-ness, my way of life, my way of thinking. If you don't think like me, out. I'm not going to relate to you. If you don't act the way I want you to act, then you are, you know, nobody. I'll not even look at you. I'll not smile at you. Why? Because you didn't do something which I think is the right thing to do. Who are we? In fact, we should rejoice that, oh, divine in me and divine in the other person. So different. What a joy. How boring and monotonous it would be. If isn't it? But this is where the problem of egoism comes. And he's saying disguises. No, no, it is not about it. Good thing, because I think so. Yes, it's good for you. By all means, one should follow what one believes to be true and good for oneself. But the moment we try to impose it on others, look at how tolerance in Sanatana Dharma has a different basis. It's not tolerating evil and everything. You can fight evil. And yet, you are still tolerant. You are not intolerant about it. Why? Because intolerance and tolerance is a state of consciousness. You have gone beyond it. You are fighting. You can fight evil with a state of compassion, even love. I mean, imagine to what extent it can go. Because even this idea that I will not fight is in mental notion, and it is also an egoism that can bind us. Altruism and indifference are often its most effective disguises. And then he gives example of Rama and Shri Krishna, and this is a beautiful example. He says how Shri Krishna first advises when Arjuna says better the life of the beggar, and Shri Krishna says, on the contrary, says, this is weakness and delusion and egoism that speak in thee. Behold the self, open thy eyes to the knowledge, purify thy soul of egoism. And afterwards, what does Shri Krishna tell him? Fight, conquer, enjoy a wealthy kingdom. What are these words? Tonic in the Gita, second chapter, it starts like that. He says, this you must renounce. And then fight. In fact, it is Shri Krishna uses the word Rajyam Samriddham. Literally enjoy the kingdom. And he's not talking about the inner kingdom there. He's saying enjoy the kingdom. You don't have to say, okay, I have, you know, fought it, won it, now I renounce and take sannyasa. Or to take another example from ancient Indian tradition, it was egoism, it would seem, that drove Rama, the avatar, to raise an army and destroy a nation in order to recover his wife from the king of Lanka. But would it have been a lesser egoism to drape himself in indifference and misusing the formal terms of the knowledge to say, I have no wife. I have no enemy. I have no desire. These are illusions of the senses. Let me cultivate the Brahma Jnana and let Ravana do what he will with the daughter of Janaka. How beautifully Sri Aurobindo reveals to us this subtle mystic truth. It is only because this personal salvation born out of a deluded egoism that took such a strong hold of the race that we lost our manhood and became what we are. And so what we have to get rid is, and that's the last we'll read, it is to be rid of what is meant by freedom from attachment. He described freedom from attachment to the forms of virtue as well as from the attraction to sin. It is to be rid of I-ness and my-ness so as to live in the one self with a capital S and act in the one self, capital S, To reject the egoism of refusing to work through the individual center of the universal being, as well as the egoism of serving the individual mind and life and body, to live to the exclusion of the others. To live in the self is not to dwell for oneself alone in the infinite, immersed and oblivious of all things in that ocean of impersonal self-delight, but it is to live as the self and in the self, equal in this embodiment and all embodiments and beyond all embodiments. This is the integral knowledge. So when we are freed from it, we are not in again some state of vast universality. Yes, of course. But we are also, we can form individual relations. We can take the joy in that, but fully aware, not losing ourselves into it, which leads to suffering, fear, unhappiness, anger, all the reactions, hatred, but with that pure original love, which uses this center, that center, expresses itself in a most beautiful way. So this is the true Brahmajnana as expounded by Sri Aurobindo and Sri Krishna. And not what we are all the time hearing about Rina. Because of this, the false antagonism, material life and spiritual life. Spiritual life enriches material life. Imagine not having spiritual knowledge and leading material life. This is what the asura is. What does he do then? There is no spiritual basis of existence. He runs over the world, destroys it. Do we want that? That we create a false antagonism, or we have a material life separate from spiritual life, which means we allow the material world to be run over by the asura seeking personal salvation. Both are egoistic and selfish modes of living. One is gross selfishness, asura, and the other is another kind of selfishness. My salvation matters. Material world, it will go on as it is. But the integral knowledge is that you recover the oneself, and then you act in this world with everything all around, its many-foldedness, without terror or fear, oh, what will happen if I don't get nirvana in one life or two life? We are not here for nirvana. We are here for the manifestation of divine in creation. Let it take centuries. But what is important is to be free of ignorance. And that's what moksha is. To recover the oneself. That is important. Because then you take delight in everything. You are not afraid of birth or non-birth or death. Because you know whether you seemingly you die or are born, you exist. Whether I live or die, I am. Thank you. Namaste.